All right, we'll go ahead and get started. Go ahead and have a seat. Thanks for coming. This is our second talk in a series called The Inner Workings of the Human Heart, which, as I said last week, sounds incredibly over ambitious. That's the word I'm looking for. You're just there to fill in the words that I can't find. That's good. Over ambitious. But really, we're just focusing in on three things. We're focusing in last week on identity, this week on joy, and next week on purpose. And as I mentioned last week, there's a lot more to be said than the things I'm going to say, both about the heart in general, but even about this topic. Even as I was within the past 15 minutes thinking about this topic, I was thinking, boy, there are so many things that I'm not going to say, that I would like to say. And that's just the way it is. That's life. So if you're interested, we can talk more afterwards. We could probably talk all night long about joy, which is our topic for tonight. I'm actually going to start by reading a short passage out of the book of Ecclesiastes, of all places. I really love the book of Ecclesiastes. I don't know about you. I don't know if you've ever read it before, but if you haven't, you should. It's very interesting and different from a lot of the other biblical literature, so it's worth reading through and pondering, reading slowly and pondering. So I'm just going to read a few verses out of Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 9 through 13, and this is what the writer says. He says, "What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that every man, every one, should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man." So I come back to these verses in Ecclesiastes actually again and again, because the writer of Ecclesiastes seems to be saying two different things. If we had read the book of Ecclesiastes up to this point, what we would have seen is that he has been saying in different ways that life and all of its pleasures are vanity. They are vapor. They're a mist that disappears. They are ephemeral, fading. And yet, he's also saying that the gift of God is to eat and drink and take pleasure in your work. The gift of God, the writer is emphasizing, is that we enjoy life. So on the one hand, he says, if you set your heart on pleasure, whether in wisdom, whether in self-indulgence, whether in sex or in money, which the writer of Ecclesiastes had all of those things, but if you set your heart on those things, you find it's all empty, he says. And yet, the gift of God is enjoying almost those same things, wisdom and work and pleasure. And so on the one hand, it's vanity, and on the other hand, it's the gift of God. And so it seems like, as you read Ecclesiastes, it almost seems like he is schizophrenic. In fact, some people have come in the book of Ecclesiastes and assumed that you actually have two different writers writing the book, and they're quoting, the one guy is quoting someone else, and then he's disagreeing with it. And then so people have taken the sort of the schizophrenic nature of Ecclesiastes so far that they've said it's actually two different people arguing about what life is really about. I actually don't think that's the case. I think it's one writer who is making a nuanced point. And he's actually saying something profound. On the one hand, all pleasure, all of the pleasure that you might pursue in life is vanity and empty and meaningless. And on the other hand, all pleasure in life is the gift of God. So we're going to talk about joy, pleasure, joy. Our outline, though, is going to be these four things: desire, disappointment, disorder, and delight. Desire, disappointment, disorder, and delight. So those are the four things that we'll talk about as we talk about this topic of joy. First, desire. So the opposite of pleasure, and I don't mean this in some philosophical way necessarily, but just existentially, the way we experience life day by day, the opposite of pleasure is pain. And we want to avoid pain of all kinds, right? We want to avoid physical pain, emotional pain, relational pain, even academic pain, right? That would be bad grades or something like that. We want to avoid the pain of loss or the pain of losing versus winning. We want to avoid the pain of guilt or embarrassment or loneliness, right? We actively spend energy to avoid pain of all kinds. Of course, at the same time, we strive then to experience joy. All of our decisions on some level are based off of what will bring us the most pleasure. In fact, the truth be told, you never do anything that you don't want to do. Now, you may think that's not true. There are lots of things I do that I don't want to do. I do things all the time that I don't want to do. I don't want to stay up late studying. I would much rather be out with my friends hanging out than staying up late reading a book on whatever that it is that you're reading. But something is driving you to study. Maybe it's a desire for good grades. Maybe it's a desire to please your parents or get a good job or a financially lucrative career. But something is driving you, and it's some kind of pleasure. Whether it's the pleasure of grades or pride in achievement or the smile of your parents or the pleasure of money somewhere down the line, right? It's some kind of pleasure, even if it's a hoped for pleasure. Like, I'm going to get this job and it's going to make me happy. So it may be a future pleasure, but it's still pleasure that's driving you, that's causing you to forsake the pleasure of the moment to study hard. So desire drives our behavior. And that makes sense because we were created to find joy in life. Ecclesiastes 3:13 that we just read says that joy is the gift of God to eat and drink and find satisfaction in your work, right? That's the gift of God. And really, the Bible teaches that throughout in different ways. One of the ways we see that in the Bible is its teaching on rest. The Bible teaches that we were created for this thing called rest. And rest is more about enjoying God's good world, right? Enjoying God's creation, receiving it as a gift and delighting in it, than it is simply about the cessation of work, right? We hear the word rest and we think it just means, okay, not doing something. But rest in the Bible is actually about actively enjoying receiving the world as a gift. And so we were created to receive life, to enjoy life as a gift from God, that one should eat and drink and find satisfaction in his toil. This is the gift of God, right? To receive life, food and drink and work as a gift and to enjoy it. In fact, many Christians would blush over how pro-pleasure the Bible sometimes is. And I'll just give two examples, two maybe obvious examples, but important examples. Proverbs chapter 5, verses 18 and 19 says this. It says, "Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth, a lovely doe, a graceful deer. Let her breasts fill you at all times with delight. Be intoxicated always in her love." Now, sex, of course, can be misappropriated, right? It can become an ugly thing, taken in the wrong context, out of context, right? But within marriage, it is meant to be, according to those verses, intoxicatingly beautiful, intoxicatingly delightful. Or think about alcohol, right? That's something else that we can abuse, and many people do, especially on a college campus, right? But what does the Bible say alcohol was created for? Psalm 104 says that God made alcohol to gladden the heart of man. Psalm 104, verse 15, that wine was given to gladden the heart of man. And so I bring those two things up in particular because they are so often abused and misused and distorted and perverted. And then as a result, they're often rejected by the church, right? So the world perverts them and distorts them. We pervert them and distort them. And then we say, oh, they're bad. But they are actually in their proper place with respect both to the law of God and man. They are very good. They are gifts for our joy. So I want you to think about what brings you lawful joy, right? Are there innocent pleasures in life that move your heart, that brighten you up, that make your heart happy? Maybe it's being with good friends or enjoying a good meal or listening to good music or sitting on the couch with your family and watching a good movie. Now, that list probably tells you more about me than possible things in life that you can enjoy, but what about you? What is it that brings you joy? What is it that just brings delight to your heart day by day? You know, one of the reasons God gives us these little enjoyments in life is to point us to the greater enjoyment in Him. C.S. Lewis, in his book Mere Christianity, talks about this. He says, most people, if they had really learned to look into their own hearts, would know that they do want, and want acutely, something that cannot be had in this world. There are all sorts of things in this world that offer to give it to you, but they never quite keep their promise. The longings which arise in us when we first fall in love, or first think of some foreign country, or first take up some subject that excites us, are longings which no marriage, no travel, no learning can really satisfy. I'm not now speaking, Lewis goes on to say, of what we would ordinarily call unsuccessful marriages or holidays or learned careers. I am speaking of the best possible ones. There was something we grasped at in that first moment of longing, which just fades away in the reality. I think everyone knows what I mean, he says. The wife may be a good wife, and the hotels and scenery may have been excellent, and chemistry may be a very interesting job, but something has evaded us. To put all that differently, right, these kinds of enjoyments are good in themselves, but often we expect something more from them, and they point us to something more to be had, right? Some greater joy, Lewis is saying. So you get to college, and you're finally free from your parents, you think, and you're finally free from your dull hometown, and you're finally, you can be happy and you can have some fun, and yet day to day it actually turns out to be the same old thing. This town is really no different from any other town. Or you graduate finally and you get into your career that you've been working for and looking forward to for years and years, and you think you finally made it big, you're finally going to enjoy life, and your job may be great, but there is this hint of something missing. There's something else, something beyond that. Or you get married and you think that your wife is going to make you the happiest man alive. And 24 hours go by, and even if you're not fighting and arguing, which hopefully you're not, but you still realize that as happy as you thought you would be, right, it hasn't lived up. It didn't make you as happy as you were thinking it would make you. That marriage didn't fulfill you the way you thought it would fulfill you. Which brings us to disappointment. I mean, you were made to be happy, you were made to enjoy life, but then disappointment comes, and it's as if God's world doesn't live up. And we find disappointment. Tim Keller talks about seven, in a talk about satisfaction, he talks about seven responses to disappointment, which I won't go into all seven. C.S. Lewis talks about two responses to disappointment, which that's a little easier, right? And really, I think we can summarize it with just the two. There are two main responses. Life happens, disappointment happens. What do we do? How do we respond? One thing that we do is we begin to make excuses, right? We begin to assign blame. And if you're an optimist, you say something like this: well, something is wrong, but I can fix it, right? There's happiness out there. I don't have it. There's some problem in my life. And if I fix that problem, then I'll be happy. Then I'll find this joy that I'm looking for. Maybe you think, well, I'm too young. I just haven't made it yet. I just need to keep working, keep moving forward. Once I graduate, once I get into my career, once I get married, then I'll be happy, right? Or this guy or this girl didn't make me happy, and I just need to keep looking, right? Maybe the next person will make me happier. And so I'm going to move on from person to person until I find that one that's going to satisfy me. Or maybe you think, well, it's my parents, right? Or my society, or the government. It's holding me back. It's slowing me down. I'm going to make it. I just need to push through these obstacles. Of course, if you're a pessimist, on the other hand, you say something is wrong and there's nothing I can do about it, right? Someone is stopping me from being happy and I can't change my situation, right? You just get this victim mentality of, this person, this organization, this thing is stopping me from being happy in life, and so I'm going to be miserable and just blame this thing. Or worst case scenario, you think something is wrong with me, right? Everybody else is happy, but look at me, I'm not happy, and it must be my fault. And so you just fall into this despair that something's wrong with life. I should be happy, but I'm not happy. Must be that there's something wrong with me, so I'm miserable. Either way, of course, whether you're blaming the world out there and you think, I can overcome this, or you're blaming the world and think, and nothing can be done, the problem, you're saying, is not that the world can't make you happy. The problem is that something is getting in the way. You just need to remove that thing, whatever it is. The other, that's the one response. That's one. The other response to disappointment is just to lower your expectations, right? Again, Keller divides this up into three different things. He says, on the one hand, you can harden your heart. You can just say, well, the search for happiness, it's a child's dream. It's not really out there. I'm just going to give it up. And you just harden your heart to the thought that real joy can be found. You could detach your heart, which is a little bit different. You know, you could say, well, suffering comes from my desires. I just need to cease to desire. I need to stop hoping that something will happen. Get rid of all expectations, and then you won't be sad anymore. Or, he says, his third is you could give away your heart. That is, life hasn't made me happy up to this point, so I'm just going to stop seeking happiness, and I'm going to lose myself in some greater cause. So there are two responses there, right? You can make excuses on the one hand, or you can lower your expectations on the other. Both of those responses, in some ways, have half the picture, right? But just a different half of the picture. On the one hand, you were made to be happy. We were made to find joy. God created us for that purpose, to find joy. But on the other hand, it's true that ultimate joy cannot be found in the things of this life. So we were created to find joy, but that joy cannot be found in the world. So what does this disappointment show us? Right? We're disappointed. We can respond to that in all different ways, but what does the disappointment actually show us? What does it teach us? Well, again, C.S. Lewis, same chapter in Mere Christianity, he says, creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. A baby feels hunger, well, there is such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim, well, there is such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire, well, there is such a thing as sex. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing. You see, the seemingly unquenchable desire, this disappointment with the present world, Lewis is saying, it actually shows us that there is something more than this present world. It's a hint, it's a clue in the universe that there's something more. Now, just because there is a desire, of course, doesn't mean that that desire will be satisfied. His point is that it could be satisfied. That the desire points to an object that is out there. Whether you ever come into contact with that object is another story, but that there is an object out there of that desire. Now, does that mean, right, that my fickle desire for the perfect cup of coffee, does that mean that there is indeed then this perfect cup of coffee out there somewhere, and if I just hold out long enough, then I'll find it? Well, no, right? But my fickle desire for this perfect cup of coffee, wherever it may be, it shows that there is some transcendent thing that my heart is fixed to that no cup of coffee can satisfy, right? That there's something more. Now, maybe it's a trivial example, but it shows that there's something more, right? That there's something better out there that my heart is longing for, that my heart is fixed to. There's something more I'm looking for beyond what any cup of coffee can supply. And that brings us to disorder, or disordered desires. If you want to know why there's so much disappointment in the world, It's not because something is always standing in the way, and it's not because there's no such thing as happiness. We could give sort of a true but general answer as Christians. Well, disappointment and sadness and pain come from sin. And that's true, but we want more than that, right? We want to go deeper than that. What does that mean? We want to go into that and understand what that means, that sin has somehow corrupted the world so that now I'm full of disappointment. We said a moment ago, and we need to come back to it, that we expect something more of innocent pleasures. And that expecting something more than they have to offer even, may sound like, well, we should just go with the second response and just lower our expectations. We're expecting too much, just lower them. But actually, that's not where we're going. That's not what I'm going to say. These kinds of innocent pleasures, right, for whatever it is, these kinds of delights in good things are destroyed when they're disordered. And here's what I mean by that. The disordered for me is a very visual thing. So, you know, sometimes you have kids line up in a classroom according to size or something like that, right? And so you have these kids, and or maybe they're lined up in order of birth date, right? And so whoever was born first is in the front and so on. And so the line has a certain order to it. Our desires are meant to be like that. They have a certain order, except it's not sort of horizontally, it's vertically, right? Our desires should have a certain order. And when our desires get out of order, when something that should be down on the list somewhere butts ahead in line and gets above up in the front, it leads to a breakdown in our lives. So Keller gives this example. He points out that if your desire for success in your career becomes greater than your desire for your family, what happens? Well, your family life begins to fall apart because you focus on your career to the neglect of your family. See, if our desires get out of order, then disorder and disintegration happens. Things begin to fall apart. Well, think about the first commandment in the Bible. That is the first of the Ten Commandments. What's the first of the Ten Commandments? It's, you shall have no other gods before me. What is God saying in that commandment? Well, at least one of the things that means is that you should not desire anything more than you desire me. Now, my favorite C.S. Lewis book, which I haven't mentioned yet, is the book The Great Divorce. And it's kind of this fanciful story of a bus trip. These people take a bus trip from hell into heaven. And it's a series of vignettes. Each chapter is a little vignette, a little picture, a little interaction between a couple of people. And the point of the book, it's showing really people who forsake the joys of heaven and decide to get back on the bus and head down to hell. There are a few people who stay, but most of the people in the book, it's showing them they get to heaven and then they decide they don't want it. They turn around, they get back on the bus and go home. And the point of the vignettes is to show why people choose the miseries of life over the joys of heaven. And in the ninth chapter of that book, Lewis explains through one of his characters what the book is about. And it's as if he's speaking to us, the reader, but he's really speaking to another character. But he says, one character to another, he says, what concerns you is the nature of the choice itself, and that you can watch them making. He goes on to say, there is always something they insist on keeping, even at the price of misery. There is always something they prefer to joy, that is, to reality. There's always something that we prefer to joy, C.S. Lewis says. And, you know, now I've spent the past, 15 minutes or so saying that we're always motivated by a desire for joy in one way or another. So what does Lewis mean by saying that there's something we prefer to joy? There's something we put ahead of joy. Well, I answer that with another Lewis quote. It's a lot of Lewis, but, you know, when in doubt, quote C.S. Lewis. In The Weight of Glory, he says, in response to the thought that our desire for good is too strong, C.S. Lewis says this: if we consider the unblushing promises of reward and the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the Gospels, it would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak We are half-hearted creatures fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased, he says. See, our desires become disordered as we set our hearts on things like winning at Candy Crush or some, you know, some game on our iPhone, or out drinking our friends, or finding satisfaction in sex, rather than setting our sights on true joy. That's what Lewis means by saying there's always something they prefer to joy. Because there's joy to be had, and we set our focus on something else in this world that we think is going to give us joy. And the Bible teaches, of course, that our supreme joy is in God. And that's what Lewis is getting at. That's the thing that's behind all of the other joys. The psalmist says at one point, "One thing have I asked of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple." The psalmist says, that's all that I want. So I just want to dwell in the Lord's house and gaze upon his beauty. Or repeatedly in the Psalms, the psalmist compares joy in God to the joy that can be had in the world. And so he says things like, "You have put more joy in my heart than they have when their grain and wine abound." See, he's saying, the people around me, they find joy in these things, but you have given me more joy. Or again, he says, "As for me, I shall behold your face in righteousness. When I awake, I shall be satisfied with your likeness." That's going to be my joy, to be satisfied with the likeness of God, to see him face to face. And so our supreme pleasure, according to the scriptures, is knowing and enjoying and serving God. When our hearts are set other places, when our desires are disordered, when our desire for God is not first, right, above all others, that is when other things begin to disappoint us. Because I'm expecting too much from this thing. It's not that I'm expecting too much out of life. It's not that I'm thinking I should be happy when happiness isn't really out there. It's that I'm expecting that happiness to come from this thing. So again, Psalm 37 says, "Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart." What does that mean? Well, it means if God is our chief joy, that God will give me what I want, himself, if God is my chief joy, right? Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart, saying if I delight myself in him, he will give himself to me so that I can delight myself in him all the more. So in that moment, as I set my heart on him, I will know joy. I'll know joy in my God. Disappointment comes when our desires are disordered, when we're trying to get from the world what can only come from God, when we're taking some desire for whatever it is, maybe it's a good thing, right, some desire down here, and I'm getting it out of order and I'm putting it first, and I'm saying, no, this is the thing that's going to make me happy. This is the thing that's going to satisfy my soul. Really, that is the essence of rebellion, according to the scriptures. You know, Adam and Eve, in the beginning, rather than setting their hearts on delighting in God, they set their hearts on becoming gods themselves. And so disappointment and frustration has been the result ever since. That this is inordinate desire, right? Desire that is out of order, out of control. Now there's one counselor named David Pallison, and he talks about these innocent pleasures and how innocent pleasures get out of control. He talks about how innocent pleasures become guilty pleasures. And he says, how can you tell when a pleasure crosses the line from innocent to guilty? Or to put it in the language that we're using, how can you tell when a pleasure has gotten out of its place in line and tried to butt ahead to the front? Pallison gives five signs, and I'm just going to list them. I'm not going to go into them. But they're helpful as you think about your own heart, the things you delight in. And he says, first of all, if the pleasure itself is plain wrong, if the thing that you're lusting after is wrong in and of itself, well, clearly that's a problem. That's an inordinate desire, a desire that is out of order. Second, he says, if the pleasure captivates you, right? If you have become obsessive about something or compulsive about something and you have to do it and you can't not do it, what does that show about that thing? Whatever it is, whether it's playing a video game or having a cup of coffee or whatever it is, that shows that that thing has gotten a hold of your heart. You become captive to it. That desire has gotten out of order. If the pleasure is hidden, he says, it shows that you know that it's an inordinate desire. You know it's a desire that has gotten out of control, and so you're hiding it from the people around you because you don't want them to see it. Even if it's an innocent thing, sometimes we hide it. It could be an innocent thing, but we hide it because we know that in our hearts it's taken over. Fourth, Pallison talks about the fourth evidence, right, that this has gotten out of control is that the pleasure steals you away from the good. So there are good things that you know you should be doing, but what you want to be doing is, and so that's what you're doing, whatever it is. And then finally, he says, if the pleasure doesn't deliver, if you are going to this thing again and again, and it's not making you as happy as you think it should make you, it's probably because you're expecting more of it than you should be expecting of it. You are expecting it to do what only God can do, satisfy your soul. Disappointment comes when our desires have become disordered, when they are out of order, when innocent pleasures become guilty pleasures. They begin to take the place of God in our life. Or as Keller puts it somewhere else, he talks about when good things become an ultimate thing, right? Something good, something that should be in the order of desire somewhere, when it becomes an ultimate thing, right? That's when it's beginning to take the place of God. Now, I said a moment ago that one of the reasons that God gives us little enjoyments in life is to point us to greater enjoyments, right? To the greater enjoyment that is found in Him. We could also say this, God often gives us over to those enjoyments in the ways that Keller describes, or that Pallison describes. He often gives us over to those enjoyments in kind of obsessive, secret, time-consuming behavior that leaves us empty, to show us that those pleasures can't fully satisfy the transcendent longing of our soul. So when we start dabbling with something and allowing our desires to get out of order, God will at times give us over to that desire. You see it in the scriptures actually again and again. God will say, okay, you want this, I will give it to you for a time. And what's the point? The point is to show us how empty that thing is so that He can point us back to Himself, that true joy can be had in Him. Well, this brings us to delight. It brings us to the last point. And, you know, what all of this means, if all of this is true, what this means is if I set my heart on God, I should know joy, right? Because what we've said is this, God is our supreme joy. He's our supreme delight. Pleasure is to be found in Him at His right hand. Disappointment comes from having these desires disordered. Having these joys or desires out of order. And so if my desires are rightly ordered, if I put God first, then I should know joy. Now this struck me as I was thinking about it this past week because I realized that I'm not a joyful person. I realized how often I lack joy. And of course, this bothered me a little bit as I'm thinking, wow, I'm not as happy as I thought I would be. I'm not as joyful as I thought I would be, as I think I, in some ways I should be, could be. And it could be, right, that the reason is everything that I'm saying is not true and Christianity is a sham. That would be one explanation. I don't think it's the right explanation, but that would be one explanation. But there's another explanation that I think better fits. And that is to nuance what we've been saying a little bit. And so what I'm going to do is give just finally four things about delight, four things about joy that help us round out this picture a little bit, that help us nuance it a little bit. And they're this. I'll give them to you at once, and then we'll talk about them. The fact that joy is a promise, that's the first. That joy is a command, that's the second. That it's found in the little things, and that it's a gift. So it's a promise, a command, it's found in the little things, and it's a gift. So first, joy is a promise. Think about these words about Jesus in Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12 says about Jesus, for the joy that was set before Him, He endured the cross. Now, I don't want to trivialize the work of Jesus, but think about this. In the same way that you endure long hours of study for the joy of a grade or the joy of a diploma or the joy of a career that is set before you, you don't have, but you're looking forward to it, hoping it. In an analogous way, Jesus endured the suffering of the cross for the joy that was set before him. Jesus endured the suffering of the cross, which means that joy and suffering are not incompatible. Right? So for the, you know, whether it's you studying and hoping to get a good grade and you're enduring this difficulty for the hope of something that is to come, or preeminently, Jesus going to the cross to suffer for sin. Why did he do that? For the joy that was set before him. Psalm 16 begins like this. Preserve me, O God, for in you I take refuge. So the psalmist is crying out to God for refuge because he's being hunted, right? He's being tracked down in some way. He's being surrounded by his enemies on some level. And he must take refuge in God. Verse 10 says, for you will not abandon my soul to Sheol or let your Holy One see corruption. His situation is so dire, he's on the edge of death, right? The edge of Sheol. Sheol is just the grave in the Old Testament. And so this person in Psalm 16, his situation is so terrible, he's on the edge of death, he's on the verge of the grave. And of course, in the New Testament, you may know that those verses are quoted about Jesus. That because he went into the grave and died for sin on the cross, and yet God did not abandon his soul to the grave, but raised him from the dead. And so you did not abandon my soul to Sheol or let your Holy One see corruption. But scattered throughout this psalm are phrases like this. I say to the Lord, you are my Lord. I have no good apart from you. The Lord is my chosen portion. I have set the Lord always before me. And then the psalm ends like this. It says, you make known to me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. And see, Jesus, though he was betrayed, surrounded by his enemies, arrested, abused, and put to death, could know joy in the midst of that. Because he knew that God would not abandon him, that whatever would happen to him, and it was bad, right? That whatever would happen to him, God was his portion. God was his good. God was his joy, despite life's difficulties. Despite death, God would be his joy. You see, Jesus came into the world and he gave up the pleasures of life to be crucified on the cross for our sin. And though he delighted in the Father perfectly, unlike us, we chase after all the things, created things around us. Jesus delighted in the Father perfectly. And yet there in that moment on the cross, the Father withdrew from him, turned his back on him, and did not give him the desires of his heart, the way Psalm 37:4 promises. But Jesus received the height of misery in the cross, so that we might know true joy in fellowship with the Father. And so joy is a promise. It's a promise for those who belong to Christ, just as it was a promise to Christ for the joy set before him. He endured the cross. He rose from the dead. He ascended to the right hand of the Father. And it's a promise for us that though we undergo all kinds of difficulties, all kinds of troubles, all kinds of suffering, that if we belong to him, we will know that joy. But joy is not only a promise, it's also a command. Now, that's kind of an odd thing for joy to be a command. Maybe Christianity is the only religion where joy is a command. I don't know, but it is a command. Philippians 4, verse 4, right? Rejoice in the Lord always, and again I will say rejoice. That's a command. That's an imperative, right? That's an exhortation. Do this. Rejoice. You know, God wants to fill us. That's the way the psalmist puts it. He says, open your mouth wide and I will fill it. Or Jesus says, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will not hunger. Whoever believes in me will never thirst. Or to the woman at the well, Jesus says, whoever drinks of the water that I give him will never be thirsty again. And all of that imagery of having our mouths filled with food and with drink. The imagery is all to the same point. It's that if and when and only when we come to God in Jesus, will we find satisfaction and joy? Will we be full instead of empty? Only as we set our hearts on God in Christ, even in the midst of the suffering of life, you know, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, the psalmist says, I will fear no evil, for God is with me, right? Even in the midst of difficulty, we can have joy because our God is with us. As we set our hearts, not on the changing circumstances around us, not on whether we get the grade, not on whether we graduate, not on whether our boyfriend or girlfriend, you know, loves us and stays with us or not, but as we set our hearts on God, on the Lord, rejoice in the Lord, as Paul says, we find joy as we focus on Him. But I take the command, right, because it's a command to rejoice, I take the command to mean that it's something that I have to do, right? Meaning, at the very least, if Paul has to command us to do it, which he does like again and again in the book of Philippians, which he's writing from jail, by the way. But again and again, he's telling us to rejoice in the Lord, meaning it's not going to happen by accident, right? I mean, how often do you accidentally obey God? And so God has to tell us, rejoice in the Lord. God commands us, He exhorts us to rejoice in the Lord. And I think the fact that it's a command that we're called to do means we have to actively set ourselves to do it, to find joy in Him. Maybe even that it is at times hard work to rejoice in Him. Hard work to set our hearts on Him, to set our sights on His promises, and not the empty promises of the world. Remember, for the joy set before Him, Jesus endured the cross. He knew God's promises, and He set His heart on those promises and endured the difficulty, right? We need to know God's promises and set our hearts on them and find joy in them rather than trying to find joy in the empty promises that the world would offer us. God in Jesus offers us joy of dwelling in His presence. Even as Jesus is now risen from the dead, sits at the right hand of the Father where there is pleasure forevermore, right? The psalmist says. And the Bible says that if we believe in Him, we will be with Him. And we will find joy in God's presence. So joy is a promise. Joy is a command. Joy is also found in the little things. You could misunderstand everything that I've been saying by thinking this. Well, when you become a Christian, you stop enjoying the things of life and you begin enjoying God in Christ, right? I don't need anything else. No other joys. I'm just enjoying God. You know, don't give me any food that tastes good, right? Give me a hard bed to sleep on. I can go without all of those things just because I have God, and that's it. That is so much not it. It's almost the opposite. You know, we've said that disappointment comes when we set our hearts on earthly things rather than God. When desires become disordered, right, inordinate, a desire for a good thing takes the place of our desire for God. And since that thing was not meant to satisfy your soul, you become disappointed with it. You become disillusioned. This thing isn't all that I had hoped it would be. This thing didn't live up to my expectations. Well, what happens then when you set your heart on God and all of your desires become rightly ordered? Innocent pleasures, David Pallison's phrase, innocent pleasures are restored. Innocent pleasures are destroyed when they're disordered because I begin to expect from those things more than I ought to expect. But if they're rightly ordered, I can actually enjoy them. Right? When things are rightly ordered, they actually become more pleasurable to me because they no longer have the bitter taste of disappointment in them. And it's simple, right? Again, take a trivial example. If I think that, you know, eating a lollipop is going to satisfy my soul, I am going to be sorely disappointed, right? But if I'm just looking for it to be some tasty treat, then I can enjoy it for what it is. Okay, that's a trivial example. Let me give you a more serious example. If you think your next relationship, your next boyfriend or girlfriend, your next, hopefully not your next husband or wife, but your husband or wife, If you think that that person is going to satisfy your soul, not only will you be disappointed, but you're also probably going to destroy that relationship because you're going to make unrealistic demands of the other person. You're going to have unrealistic expectations that they are going to make me happy. And they can't do that. They can't satisfy your soul. But if you're just looking, but if you are first satisfied in God and you know your delight is in Him, then you can look at that person and look to them to be your companion. You can enjoy them. You can delight in them. Only when you're satisfied in God can you enjoy someone for all that they have to give as a person, in some ways without the bitter taste that they can't satisfy your deepest longings. Really, as a Christian, the world actually becomes a garden of God's delights to enjoy in their proper place. As gifts from the one who can satisfy your soul, as tokens of His all-satisfying goodness, as signs of something even greater, of something even more satisfying. Again, David Pallison concludes as he's talking about this. He says, innocent pleasures don't pretend to save you or protect you. They don't promise you meaning and identity in life. They don't take life's fragility, pain, and frustration, and disappointment, and uncertainty and wash them away. They are not the giver of every good and perfect gift. They are just gifts that you enjoy. They are innocent because they don't pretend to be anything more. To eat and drink and find satisfaction in your toil, this is the gift of God. So joy is a promise. Joy is a command. It's found in the little things, right? And joy is a gift. It's a promise, a command. It's found in the little things. And to emphasize, it's a gift. You know, my mind and my heart don't always agree. In fact, probably 95% of the time, they are working at odds with one another. And one of my problems is that I don't rest in God enough to simply enjoy the life that He's given me. I'm restless, running around trying to find something to make me happy, rather than resting in the life that He's given and the goodness that He's given. I need to fight to rest in His love so that I can enjoy His world. I don't always believe His promises. I don't always believe that He is my supreme joy. I don't always believe that there are pleasures at His right hand forevermore. And so joy is something that we must fight for. And yet, I've already said that, but yet, joy is something that we cannot manufacture. I can't coerce my heart into being happy. I can't just sit here, and if I'm just going to think long enough and, you know, tweak the right knobs or turn the right buttons or flip the right switches, and I'm going to make myself be happy. I can't do that. Romans 15:13, though, says, may the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, so that by the power of the Holy Spirit you may abound in hope. Right? What does that verse say joy comes from? God must fill you with joy by the power of His Spirit. Joy is a gift, right? It comes from Him. Jesus said we should ask for the Holy Spirit and that the one who asks receives. And so to apply that to our present discussion, Jesus says later on, what father, if his son asks for joy, would give him misery? Now, it may be joy in the midst of suffering. It may be joy in the midst of pain. It may even be a joy that comes and goes. It's certainly going to be a joy that we have to fight for daily. But it will be joy in the one thing that lasts, joy in the Lord. The Lord who will never fade, right? Who won't pass away, who is not ephemeral, who is not a vapor and a mist that is passing. The Lord who is solid and eternal. Won't you ask Him for it, right? Won't you ask God for His Spirit and to fill you with His joy? Now, there are lots of other things I'd like to say. There's a lot more that we could say about joy, but I should stop there. And let me say this. Let me say three things, maybe. One, I know this is like a deluge, but if you have questions, I'm going to hang out now and keep talking. And if you have questions that you don't get talk about right now, or just you're thinking about it later and you want to talk more about it, tomorrow I'm going to be at the Union for lunch in the basement on the south side near the bowling alley and the vending machines. I'm getting this down. I know where it is now. I know where we're going to be. So in the Union, in the basement, on the south side of that cafeteria. Do they call it a cafeteria? What do they call it? Cafeteria? The dining area. The what? Food court? Okay, the food court. So in the basement, in the food court, on the south side near the bowling alley and the vending machines. We'll be somewhere there, and I'll be wearing the shirt that Ben has on right now, the blue All Souls shirt, right? So you can come tomorrow to hang out for lunch to either ask questions or just to hang out and talk or whatever. And then the last thing is that I think the last talk was put up online, and this one probably will be too. And so since I said so much so fast, if you're wondering what did he say about that and you wanted to go back and listen to it, it would be there online. So so let's go have some cookies, which are in the back, and enjoy them to the glory of God in their rightful place.